Evening, Dan.
Hi, Omar. How are you?
I'm very good, thanks. How are you doing?
Yeah, it's been a couple of weeks. I feel invigorated and ready.
Yeah. Well, just as the season's coming to a close.
Perfect timing.
Yeah, but ton to get through. Like, there's been a lot happening.
Well, we added to the list today, didn't we? We were going to start off with just one or two things, and actually, we've realised there's quite a lot of lines of discussion on various different sort of interconnecting parts. So I'm looking forward to getting through quite a lot of parts of the football pie as usual.
Yeah, I quickly changed the title of this space to add the Saudi dollars. I was speaking with a journalist earlier who told me that his editor was saying to him that anything Saudi is selling at the moment. So hopefully that's a lead indicator for listeners to this space in the pod.
Well, I think so, and I mean, I think obviously the one of the most interesting elements of all of it, and we'll go on to the sort of wider geopolitical stuff shortly, is, you know, closer to home on the Premier League side, really. And I know that we obviously start and some of the bias is obviously towards Premier League, because that's a lot of the stuff that we do and see and read and consume and talk about more generally. But I think one of the things that I was really keen to get your views on in a few different ways was, obviously, now Premier League season finished, we've got Conference League, we've got Champions League, then we have a little bit of a break before everything reignites with the World Cup and then pre-season and everything from it. But I know you guys are very much into digging into the detail of how well Premier League teams have done over this season. I know you've had some great pieces in the Times and the Financial Times recently as well, and you've crunched a few numbers on under and overachieving EPL teams. Would be great just to dig into a bit of that detail, perhaps.
Yeah, absolutely. So we do a collaboration with Martin Ziegler at the Times every year now on this kind of value for money Premier League table, which basically looks at how much teams have spent in wages, transfer fees, and agents' fees, and then sees who's over and underperformed that. And we know that, you know, the more you spend, well, there's a positive correlation between how much you spend in the league and where you finish in the league, but it's certainly not a one-to-one relationship. So around about this time of year, maybe a couple of months ago, all clubs released their accounts. Unfortunately, it's for the previous season, 21-22 season. But generally, you know, obviously spending is correlated year to year. And we also know for promoted teams historically how much they tend to spend in wages and amortization upon promotion. And unfortunately, also, we've got the agents' fees as well from the most recent season. So we're able to kind of piece it all together to get a sense of who the biggest spenders are and who the lower spenders are. And I suppose it's an interesting point to flag right off the bat, is that in terms of total costs, so wages, amortization and agents' fees, in terms of total costs, the biggest spenders in the league there's kind of like a top three, which is Man United first, and Man City and Chelsea basically tied second. And I don't think that necessarily always correlates to people's perceptions. I think a lot of people think, Man City spend a lot more than everyone else. Now, you know, where there's obviously a dispute at the moment about where they get the revenues, but in terms of their wage costs and amortization is kind of in line with those two other clubs. And Liverpool a little bit further behind, about 10% back on those other teams. And then you have a pretty big gap, actually, down to Arsenal and Spurs. First Arsenal and then Spurs. So firstly, yeah, I think there's a bit of kind of alignment as to how much clubs spend. And then what you can do is draw the correlation between points and spend and see who is essentially above that line or below that line. And this season we had Arsenal most above the line. So their spending was 354 million, which off the top of my head was something like 70% above the league median. And typically when you look at teams with similar wage bills historically, they would expect to get 60 points. Arsenal obviously got 84, so that's a difference of 24 points. So it's a massive overachievement, which I don't think anyone would disagree with. And they may not have won the Premier League, but they've won the pound for pound league table, which it doesn't get your trophy, but I suppose it's something to... It's a feather in the cap for Arsenal. And at the opposite end of the scale, Chelsea, a team with their spending, typically if you're one of the kind of top three or so spenders in the league, Actually, your average points is really around high 70s, 80. There's so much variability around that. Some teams get 90 points, some teams get 60 points. So Chelsea were expected to get about 77 points. They got 44, which is an underachievement of 33, which is pretty much the biggest that we've seen since we've been doing this analysis for Martin over the last 6 years or so. So big variability there where teams can, you know, massively outperform expectations by about 25 points all the way to underperforming by about 30 odd.
I'm just looking at the table, sorry, as you sort of go through it as well, which is fascinating. Maybe the one that I found almost as fascinating were, and without too much prompting, I was thinking Forest and Spurs on that table for maybe slightly different reasons, in that it looked like Forest had more or less been par for the course, and Spurs had sort of got slightly more points than was expected. Have I read that table right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So, yeah, I think Spurs is the one that surprises people because, you know, the narrative around Spurs last season was that it was a pretty significant, a poor season, really. But actually, if you look at their level of spending, it's something like, and again, I'm going off the top of my head here, something like 50% above the median club in the league. And so all we're doing is looking at historically teams that have similar levels of spend above the median club in the league, and actually the average is typically about 55 points. So for Spurs to get 60 points is kind of overachievement, and Spurs are the victim of their own success in some ways because they have consistently overachieved for a number of years. Under Pochettino, they were overachieving by 15 to 20 points a season. So there's an element here of the fact that expectations have been aligned based on the historic performance rather than their overall spending. And with Forest, obviously, we're making an approximation given they got promoted. And so we're trying to understand the extent to which their spending has gone up. We estimated their total cost to be about $111 million this season, which was obviously below the league median. We thought it was probably one of the bottom two clubs this season, the other one being Brentford, based on their spend last year. And so obviously, if you're one of the bottom two spenders in the league, your expected points are about 37. So they... getting 38 points, which is just about survival on average. It's pretty much in line with expected.
The other one I was going to just mention briefly, which I think deserves obviously quite a mention, is Brentford. Just in terms of wages, I know that's the 21-22 wages, but you know they are effectively the outlier in the. I know we've got a 1 year lag effectively, so we might apportion a little bit more in terms of wage spend for this current season just gone, but I still find it absolutely incredible that the 21-22 wages were 68 million with the amortization takes it up to 97, but you know everybody else, you know, Forest, Bournemouth 86-89, and you know they're effectively seen as the outlier in terms of a 23 point actual difference to what was expected, which just seems extraordinary and just goes to show what a great job has everyone in that club has done this season.
Yeah, and I wouldn't have thought their wage costs would have gone up significantly this year. Yeah, Forest and Bournemouth have estimated to have high wages. It would have been actually their wage costs would have been similar to what Brentford's was last year as well, partly because they've pay promotion bonuses, which tend to be pretty significant and go into the wage bill. But yeah, no, Brentford consistently since promotion overachieved versus budget. So yeah, model of a well-run club alongside Brighton, who are also overachievers by about 20 points according to the analysis.
And obviously, I guess it's the same, you know, with Newcastle and Brighton. And I guess to an extent, the question, which we don't necessarily need to answer now, is, you know, how can those clubs maintain and sustain that level of performance over more than one season, especially when players leave, managers get picked off, particular systems get found out, and, formations have to change accordingly, and there's less of a surprise. I guess the benchmark for sustainability is being able to stay above that median line over a sustained period of time.
Yeah, exactly, which, as you say, not that many teams do. As mentioned earlier, Spurs were one of those teams and generally have been, I mean, consistently overachieving. Brighton, actually, when they first got promoted, weren't. But now, over the last couple of years, they certainly have. Brentford obviously have over a couple of years. So it's not easy to do. City have done it consistently under Guardiola. But yeah, constantly kind of being a pound for pound successful team isn't easy as reflection of good operational processes. And we've seen even like Liverpool this year who have been consistently above the line this year, underachieving. And actually we forget Liverpool are now pretty significant spenders in the league, the fourth biggest wage spenders. That certainly wasn't the case. We'll call it kind of 6-7 years ago before all the success that they've had. Is it worth getting on to some of the agents' regs news with the successful challenge this week in Germany?
Yeah, more than happy just to give everyone a bit of update. I mean, you know, looking at the analytics actually of our podcast, Omar, one of the outliers actually was our chat on the agents' regs, and I think that's probably more down to the questioning than my answers, in truth.
Not the slightest. But
there's really significant developments that happened over the last few weeks in Germany. So, by way of very brief recap, we have the situation where new FIFA agents rules are being put in place, controversial because there is a commission cap and other restrictions that are in potentially going to be put in place, including an exam and the lack of guaranteed commission that will be applicable, and the player paying rule effectively, which is going to be coming into force now. Agents have stuck their arms up in horror at this and have been plotting in different jurisdictions legal challenges. I think I remember chatting about one particular challenge, which was in the Dutch courts, which actually failed relatively recently. I was at a conference where I actually said that, you know, what was the likelihood of another set of agents' associations being able to successfully injunct, which is what looks likely to happen or has happened, the FIFA rules. And only a few days after that conference, it was announced, I only saw it on LinkedIn actually, that a German regional court, I believe, had heard a claim against FIFA that was then deemed successful, and that effectively then froze the implementation of the FIFA regulations, which obviously then included the commission cap and everything else. Now, the query is going to be, number one, whether FIFA appeal that decision. If they do and are successful, then fine, we're still in the same state that the rules are going to be implemented, unless there's another challenge. But if they don't appeal or aren't successful on that appeal, then there's all types of different conundrums which might start up, which along the lines of, well, if it can't be implemented in Germany, whilst there is a European court decision pending, which might take a few years, you know, how can sort of unequal implementation of FIFA rules occur in different countries? So there's a query about whether, if that's the case and FIFA lose on appeal, whether actually FIFA don't implement their regulations across all of these jurisdictions, and then the regulations are pending the outcome of what will be a court of justice decision, in the same way as, you might recall, there is over the Super League matter at the moment, which has taken obviously significant amounts of time too. So although that hopefully is a bit of a whistle-stop tour of the current state of play, there's obviously quite a lot going to then still happen in the summer. There's a question about whether other agents' associations will still then do the same in their national jurisdiction and maybe piggyback to some degree off the submissions and the evidence that was used in the German case, for example. So I think watch this space, because it's going to be an interesting summer. There's obviously a query about whether the agents are still going to need to take the exam in September, whether the regs are going to still be implemented come October. So, you know, a lot of moving parts at the moment. And that obviously is still aligned with all the national associations are still having to implement their set of domestic rules. Because remember, the FIFA regs only cover international transfers and transfers that agents are doing internationally. So the national associations are in you know, a difficult predicament now, because what are they going to do? Are they going to implement national rules, which may be dependent on what happens at FIFA level and all of these national courts? So a dynamic time, would be fair to say right now.
Yeah, definitely. And on the national regs, how quickly is it? Because as you said, there's a lot of moving parts. Like, how quickly can they respond to these things, or is it quite a long time? I guess they aim to mirror as much as possible the FIFA regs, but does it take time to decide, you know, to react to what FIFA's doing?
Exactly right. So, you know, my understanding is a lot of national associations have been aiming to draft and finalize their regulations in time for October. Now, does this all put a bit of a spanner in the works for everything? Quite possibly. But I think all the associations have to be sort of prepared. And FIFA have provided sort of model template for the national associations to adhere to. But again, who knows? I think all we do know is for the summer window, everything carries on as normal under the current regulatory framework, which at the moment doesn't cut into the FIFA regs too much just yet. But as on implementation from the beginning of October, depending on what happens over the summer in the courts in the next few months, it's a little bit of a holding pattern, to be fair.
And Germany's not the only place, right, that there's disputes. There's others that are likely to come in elsewhere.
Exactly right. So the reports are that there might be those cases in England developing over the next weeks and months, in Switzerland, in Italy and Spain even as well, potentially. And that's just obviously in Europe that might be replicated across the rest of the world. We do know that there is a CAS case actually occurring relatively soon as well, where there's going to be competition law arguments raised too. So again, watch this space among different courts and different jurisdictions at different levels of the sporting pyramid.
Yeah, fascinating. And on the subject of FIFA regs, the moves by, I guess, was it PIF, or was it certainly the kind of changes to the structure of those four clubs in Saudi Arabia this week? Talk us through, I guess, what's permissible under FIFA regs and where some of the grey areas are potentially here.
Well, yeah, I mean, we talked about this before, and I'd be really interested in your thoughts maybe on, obviously, there's quite a lot of transfer speculation around Benzema, around Kante, around plenty of footballers who look like they're being offered, you know, pretty large sums to be able to go off into the league. And it was actually something I was thinking about, and then one of my good pals in the US, Andrew Wisnowski, tweeted something yesterday around the FIFA statutes, and particularly Article 20. So if you might remember, we've talked previously about multi-club ownership and the issues around whether two clubs that are controlled by the same entity can play in the same competition. Well, the FIFA statutes actually do make reference to this point as well, and it's Article 20.2, that I'll just read briefly, which says, "Every member association shall ensure that its affiliated clubs can take all decisions on any matters regarding membership independently of any external body. And in any case, the member association shall ensure that neither a natural nor legal person," and then some written brackets, "exercises control in any manner whatsoever over more than one club whenever the integrity of any match or competition could be jeopardized." So cutting through the legal jargon, it's a similar point, I think, in principle, which is I think the league needs to be careful that if four of its biggest clubs have come under effectively common ownership or common control, about ensuring that all of those clubs' decision-making capabilities are still at an arm's length basis. So otherwise, there might be some FIFA issues that might need to be dealt with. I hadn't remembered that that statute for quite a while, actually, because it hasn't really come up in too many ways. But I think that's definitely something to bearing in mind the issues we talked about around integrity of competition, integrity of outcome, whether, you know, if there's one ownership group that owns a number of those teams, whether it's beneficial for one team to win over the other, for sporting, for political, or for other reasons. So I think PIF and or the sovereign wealth fund that's controlling those clubs now needs to tread very carefully with FIFA, to be fair.
Yeah, out of interest, where's the line here on what FIFA regulate versus what individual leagues regulate? Because I'm aware of certain leagues that are pretty prescriptive to owners around, you know, if you own a club here, then, you know, it's got to be operating in the interest of you know, the club in this league and the context of the league. Other leagues have very kind of lightweight ownership tests and almost don't really care, maybe not the right word, but they don't really care about what you do in a league. So how does FIFA get wrapped up in this whole, conflict of interest or driving of interest of clubs?
Yeah, I think it's multi-layered in truth, and that's what happens when you have regulations at the National Association, League, national competition, international club competition, and then overarching FIFA level. So, for example, without wanting to get too complicated, it might well be that there are FA regulations on this, there are Premier League regulations on this, there are EFL regulations on this, there is then FA Cup regulations on this, there would then be UEFA regulations on multi-club, as we've talked about previously, and now FIFA. So the FIFA seems, I would probably say, less prescriptive and more purposive, if that's the right word to say it, which is something to ensure about. But I'd be hugely shocked if, you know, the right people at the right organization hadn't been consulting with FIFA on what can and can't be done. But again, you know, the wider issue is, and I'd be really interested in your thoughts more generally, is we're now seeing, you know, some of the best players in the world effectively upping and heading off to the league now. And there's going to be some real iconic stars playing sooner rather than later, and probably more to come.
Yeah, definitely. So it's been, obviously, we've known about it for a little bit of period of time with Ronaldo and news about Benzema and so on, and others have emerged. I think yesterday, for me, was a real wake-up call with the news that we saw with LIV Golf, or more strictly speaking, the kind of joint venture between DP World Tour and PGA Tour and PIF. And, you know, ostensibly what's happened here is that, you know, Saudi Arabia's bought golf, has bought the sport, and it now has kind of global influence on the sport, which is very different to having a competition within a sport and having a lot of money thrown at it, which is what LIV Golf was. And so when you see what's happened there, you begin to think about, well, what does kind of owning football look like? And I don't think it's the model that people assume, or the model that's been playing out at the moment, which is obviously, you know, recruiting players to the Saudi Pro League. The Saudi Pro League, I mean, we think about, the way that we think about competitions, we break it down into three core drivers of value. The first is quality. You need the best players playing against each other on a regular basis, and then kind of being fit and available to play, which obviously they're going hard at by recruiting very good players, maybe not quite their peak, but still very, very good players. What they will lack in quality, though, will be the domestic talent pool, and that will always be an issue unless you go fully international. So that's, there's certainly checks there in terms of quality, but the odd cross too. Jeopardy, you need kind of competitive balance in the league, which is provided the players are distributed sensibly across teams, then you should have that, and you might introduce playoffs and so on to make things more interesting. But the biggest gap that they've got is on kind of what we call connection, which is a reason for fans to care. At the moment, you and I wouldn't know really anything about any of the Saudi Pro League teams. We wouldn't know anything about their history. And to be honest, we wouldn't really care. You think about clubs that you care about in other leagues, or even kind of keep an eye on in other leagues. They've got some kind of history, some kind of tradition, great players in the past, you know, some kind of heritage. And these Saudi clubs presumably don't. I mean, maybe I'm doing them a disservice, but certainly to European eyes, they don't. And that is very difficult to build. It's, you know, that sort of stuff that football heritage is not built overnight, is built over multiple generations. You know, the reason the Premier League is one of the most popular leagues in the world is because people care about the history and the tradition of the league as much as anything else. It creates authenticity. So what I think is a logical conclusion, and, you know, this is shooting from the hip a little bit, but a logical conclusion for me is that, you've got teams that aren't set up in Saudi Arabia because the Saudi market isn't huge. So you begin to go, okay, well, where do we want to grow the game? Where do we want to have influence? Well, why don't we have a team in Shanghai? Why don't we have a team in Mumbai? Why don't we have a team in Jakarta? Why don't we have a team in London, New York, Nairobi, you know, wherever it is a Super League in some respects, but with brand new teams, with teams that haven't previously existed. And with those teams, you create some connection with local fan bases in big markets. You move away from the kind of Saudi branding, which people won't necessarily engage with, move towards a more global branding, which people might have a better connection to. And so, yeah, it wouldn't surprise me. And obviously, you know, the biggest hurdle on all this is governance and, you know, yeah, what you're allowed to do within the confines of you know, various competitions today and regulators and rights holders today. I think that that is a challenge. But we've seen in LIV Golf, if the check is, or in golf, if the check is big enough, then you can certainly have things your way. So, yeah, painting a vision of football here, which you can't underestimate how different football might look in 10 years' time here. And what football has got that's different to golf is that, to be honest, I don't think casual golf fans, or even, you know, slightly more than casual golf fans, really care about the PGA Tour. They care about the majors, they care about the Ryder Cup. I think football fans clearly care more about, you know, the clubs and the week-to-week narratives a lot more than they do in golf. So that there'll be a huge amount of resistance there, and that is what's different. But yeah, I think it's very much kind of watch this space at the moment with the influence of Saudi money in football.
No, that's fascinating insight, and thanks for that. And might just end on Man City, if that's all right, for just a couple of minutes on. Obviously, I know that there was a piece that you contributed to on sort of City dominance, and then maybe, without going into too much detail or as much as you want to, on what, you know, City's chances of the treble are looking like. I know we talked about the stats a few weeks ago before that, but yeah, a few minutes on City to end is probably quite apt in a few different ways.
Yeah, in definitely a few different ways. So yeah, I spoke to, contributed to a piece in the FT a couple of weeks ago on, you know, City winning the Premier League 5 years out of 6. Does the Premier League have a Bundesliga problem? Which I guess is interesting in the context of Bundesliga having a crazy last day, you know, a couple of weeks ago. But my answer to that is probably no. One way we look at jeopardy is basically look at the average odds over the course of a season, rather than just looking at the eventual outcome. Because the way that we enjoy seasons is not by the eventual outcome, it's the kind of journey that you go on during it. And if we look at the Premier League, in the last 6 Premier League seasons, that includes Liverpool's title win in 2020, the eventual Premier League champions had on average a 74% chance of winning the league over the course of the season. So they've been, you know, whichever those teams, usually Man City, one time Liverpool, they've been kind of strong favourites on average over the course of the season, but it hasn't been a done deal. Whereas you compare that to Bayern Munich, it's 89% on average over the course of Bundesliga seasons. Over the last six years or so in Liga, it's about 85% on average. So those leagues have not had uncertainty, or have had a lot less uncertainty over the course of the season. And I guess on a similar theme, looking ahead to the Champions League final, our models have, just getting up here, our models have Man City 78% favourites to lift the trophy against Inter. I mean, Inter are a very good team. They're ninth best in the world in our models, but City are just a different level at the moment. And so they're strong favourites, but, you know, not ridiculously so. You know, 1 in 5 chance of it being Inter. You know, to bring that into the real world, let's say equivalent, you're more likely to roll a 6, call it, or rather the chance of Inter winning are more likely than rolling a 6 on a die, and you can perfectly imagine kind of rolling a die and getting a particular number. So yeah, should be a City treble, but you know, there's the great thing about football is that any final is very, very rarely a done deal.
Well, I like the references to Dundee a few times, and there's some good product placement going on, Omar, so much appreciated on that front.
Very good. All right, mate, plenty to get through, but I think it was hopefully all interesting as usual.
And good luck for West Ham tonight.
Yes, absolutely. All right, mate, take care.
Take care, thanks.
Thanks for listening. You can follow me on Twitter, TikTok and Instagram at Football Law, read my blogs and listen to my previous podcasts via my website, danielg.com/blogs. Please do subscribe to the Done Deal Football Podcast, like, share, and tag me. If you like the content, if not my voice, you'll probably also like my book, Done Deal, an insider's guide to football contracts, multi-million pound transfers, and Premier League big business. A bit of a mouthful. It's available to buy in hard copy, digitally, and via Audible. All links are in the podcast show notes. Lastly, the podcast is powered by 13, which is a fashion brand I've started. All proceeds go towards cancer charity research, and particularly the stellar work done by John Krell, who has helped my mum through some difficult times over the last few years. You can take a look at the merch and hopefully buy a t-shirt, hoodie, cap, or all three. Please do spread the word and go to 13shop.co.uk. That's 13shop.co.uk. Thanks for listening.